Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia, in for Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the fallout continues after a stabbing on the Lynx Blue Line. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles calls a special meeting this week of the Metropolitan Transit Commission, which oversees the Charlotte area transit system. Kat says the man accused of the stabbing did not purchase a ticket prior to the incident and that it will address fare evasion more aggressively. Early voting continues, and turnout has been less than stellar. Entering this week, less than 1,000 voters had cast ballots. That's out of hundreds of thousands of eligible voters. 8 additional voting locations open this week across the city. Election day is September 9th. And school is underway, but it's testing data from last year. That's news this week. Statewide test scores have been released. Heading into this week, CMS hinted that the results would be historic. We'll take a closer look. And the NFL is back. The Carolina Panthers kick off the regular season this weekend. Our roundtable of reporters this morning include Joe Bruno, WSOC-TV reporter, Steve Harrison, WFAE's political reporter, James Farrell, our education reporter at WFAE, and Ben Thompson, the morning and midday anchor of WCNC Charlotte. Happy Friday. Thank you all for joining us.
Happy Friday.
Good morning.
So we're starting off with a story that's been in the news for the past couple of weeks, which has raised more safety concerns on mass transit in Charlotte. On August 22nd, a 23-year-old woman, Irina Zarutska, was stabbed and killed on the light rail in Southend. She was a Ukrainian refugee who recently fled from Russia. DeCarlos Brown Jr. is accused of killing her. He's charged with first-degree murder. The two did not know each other, and Brown's mother told WSOC that he suffers from schizophrenia. The incident has really rocked the community and the public, and city council members have had a lot of questions as to how this all happened. Eric Onis, the chief safety and security officer for CATS, told WFSOC's Hunter Sines last week that there was no way that this death could have been prevented.
There was absolutely no behavioral cues that would have triggered an interaction with this individual. He wasn't sweating, he wasn't talking to himself, he wasn't interfacing in a manner that would have triggered attention to him that he was about to do a heinous act. And then all of a sudden you see his face change, he commits the act, and it's in a split second.
So, Steve, before we get into the transit-related meetings that took place this week, let's talk about how security on CATS trains and buses are supposed to work. What does security staffing look like for mass transit commuters in Charlotte?
Yeah, I think the big thing is that on the light rail, the system was designed with like open platforms, meaning, you know, if you go to New York City or Washington, there's turnstiles and you, in theory, have to have a ticket to get to the platform and onto the train. The light rail here doesn't do that. It is an open system. It's kind of in a way an honor code in terms of whether you bought a ticket or not. In theory, there are people who come through and check tickets and make sure you have a ticket. And if you don't, you're given a citation. But over the last, you know, 10, 12 years, that system of checking tickets has really slipped. And I think, Joe, you've reported, at times is almost non-existent. And so, again, over the space of many, many years, it's become a train where a lot of people feel like you could just walk on and off and don't have to pay. And in theory, there are supposed to be people providing security on and off the train, on the platforms. But again, there's a sense that that's not really happening.
CATS has said that the man accused of the stabbing did not purchase a ticket prior to the incident. Here's what interim CATS CEO Brent Cagle said to City Council on Tuesday night.
Mr. Brown entered the system, the transit system, that day via bus. He rode, and it does not appear that he presented a pass or a ticket. He rode to the transit center, where he then transferred over to the Blue Line and rode out into South End.
That sound comes to us courtesy of WSOC. So, Steve, you mentioned that there is sort of this honor system when it comes to riding the train in Charlotte. But do we know how common this is for someone to get on a bus without paying? That seems like it might be a little bit harder to get away with.
It is, because there is this interaction with the driver as you get on the bus. And so you're making eye contact with, and if you don't have a ticket. But CATS has kind of told its drivers that if someone comes in and doesn't have a ticket, then it's really not, they're not supposed to challenge the rider, and is supposed to allow them to get on. And I think you can see why the transit system has made that decision. These drivers have felt like they are not safe over many, many years. You don't want to escalate a situation over a $2.20 ticket. So again, kind of another way in which the rules that have been put in place have kind of have broken down, I guess.
Joe.
Yeah, it was a surprise. I think that was news when he said that he not only evaded the fare on the light rail, but he also got on the bus and didn't pay, because there is that interaction. And I don't think a lot of people expect there to be fare evasion on buses, or at least not a significant amount, because of that interaction. But the way that the bus drivers are trained is basically, if somebody is just blowing past the payment, then to just let them go, and they have a button that they can discreetly press to mark them as not paying in that scenario.
Ben.
Yeah, I can remember the first time I actually rode the Blue Line right after it opened in 2007. And my experience before that, to Steve's point, was New York and Washington. And even though I had covered the Blue Line and its opening up to that point, I was surprised when I got to the platform and I didn't see a turnstile. And if you've not ridden the Blue Line, or if you're familiar with other systems, you might be surprised when you get there. And it has what is called open platform. And Portland, Minneapolis, Denver, several other cities have this, popular in Europe as well. And it's faster. The flow is faster. The infrastructure is a lot cheaper for cities like Charlotte to put in place. But the one consistent concern among city leaders, Charlotte and otherwise, is safety, because you don't have buy-in from that person. The idea being that if you have someone buying a ticket, you know, investing some of their money to be on the platform, they're going to be less likely to cause mischief because they paid to be there. So we've actually seen that trend in other places, that safety is a consistent concern you don't have at accountability of every single person actually paying to be on that train or bus.
Well, speaking of safety, during the city council meeting on Tuesday night, council member Dimple Ajmera said that this stabbing was preventable.
He may not have been able to board the bus to begin with. So that means our controls would have worked, and we would have been able to save Arena Zaruski's life.
Is that fair to say that this was preventable, that if these, you know, safeguards had been in place, if there had been this check on while he got on the bus, that she would still be alive? I mean, is that a fair statement, Steve?
I think it's fair in theory. I mean, it definitely at kind of a high level. Yes, if he had been denied access to the bus, then this all might not have happened. But I do think it's hard to require bus drivers to be fare inspectors and to deny people entry, and then that's going to escalate, potentially get into an argument, and then, you know, perhaps the rider takes out their frustrations on the bus driver. It's a difficult situation. I think it's really hard to make bus drivers who aren't armed, who aren't protected, who are just up there in the front of the bus all alone, to be the heavy in this situation. That's a big ask.
Joe.
Yeah, I think if you want to consider their security lapse or failure, it's more on the onus of the light rail than the bus, because I don't think people reasonably expect bus drivers to act as security when they're trying to focus on the road and make sure, you know, people pay and stuff. But you could argue that had the light rail had security, or had their fare inspectors on board like they were supposed to, then maybe he would have been kicked off the train sooner. And this is just one part of this whole thing. It's a failure of massive proportions, not just fare evasion. We're talking about mental health system. We're talking about courts. There are a lot of different factors in play here. But I do think that fare evasion and fare enforcement is one thing that the city can and will look at as a result of this.
Ben.
And if I can take this even wider at this point, I know our newsroom, but I also know newsrooms across this city, treat random crime, a crime like this, very differently than they treat any other. That's why you've seen so much news coverage about this. And that is, aside from the transit angle, which is an important one, this appears to be totally random. Mm. And so often, and CMPD will tell you this as well, so often the crime that happens in the city is domestic in nature, in that the suspect and the victim know each other, and there was an argument leading up to it, or something like that. That's not the case in this, and that's why this is so scary. This is why this has really galvanized the community in a lot of ways, is because this appears to be a perfectly random person going up to another perfectly random person on the light rail. And that means that honestly could have been any of us if we were there at the time. And that's scary.
Is there a sense of what the temperature in the room is like between interim CAT CEO Brent Cagle right now and Charlotte City Council? I mean, just judging by some of the reporting that I've been reading up on this week, it feels like there could be some tension, some, looking for someone not necessarily to blame, but someone to really ask some hard questions of right now as we kind of grapple with how this was possible. Steve, do you have a read on that at all?
I think council generally has faith in Brent Cagle. He's been on the job, I guess, as interim for about 2 years. And, you know, in his defense, the CATS has tripled the amount of money that it spends on security from, I think, a little under $6 million in 2023 to $18 million now, because they've been dealing with so many problems on buses and at the main bus station uptown. That's always been the focus. I think Cagle is generally seen as a really strong operations person in terms of, like, blocking and tackling and making the transit system work as possible. But the problems that he's dealing with have kind of been festering for years and years. And you have this situation where, with each week or month that goes by, just an increasing sense of a little bit of lawlessness on the transit system. And that's really hard to unwind in a short period of time.
Well, as far as what's next, Cagle says that CATS plans to have a new fare enforcement team that works separately from security staff. He says they'll be on the light rail more often, but still he cautions there are limits.
It is not possible in a system our size to check every ticket for every passenger for every ride. So the goal is to have visible presence so that people more often than not will see security or will have their tickets checked.
Do we have a sense of when this new team is going to be put in place, Joe?
I don't have a timeline. I think they're just vowing to increase enforcement in general. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw more of a presence as soon as this weekend. I think that there is power in presence. This isn't about enforcing $2.20. Like, CATS makes like $17 million in revenue from ticket fares. It's like 7 to 10% of their budget. It's a significant amount of money, but truthfully, CATS could probably live without it, especially if the sales tax increase passes. This isn't about collecting that $2. I think that it sends a message, and I think it is an admirable goal for people to just get in their mind that, hey, more than likely there will be somebody on the train providing security and checking for fares. I better pay. And maybe just having that mindset will help deter things happening that shouldn't on the train.
More to talk about with transit when we return. This is the Friday News Roundup on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks. I'm Sarah D'Elia in for Mike Collins. It's the Friday News Roundup, and our roundtable of reporters this morning includes Joe Bruno with WSOC, Steve Harrison and James Farrell with WFAE, and Ben Thompson with WCNC. We're talking about transit. There's a lot to cover this week, and related to the ongoing issue we've been talking about with security with mass transit, we have the issue of the transit tax, which voters will have the chance to vote for or against in November. The plan would build the Red Line commuter train to Cornelius and other North Mecklenburg towns, and it would also expand local bus service, pay for road improvements, and create a new transit authority to run the system. If voters approve, Mecklenburg County sales taxes would rise to 8.25%. Charlotte Mayor Vi Lyles called a special meeting this week of the Metropolitan Transit Commission, which oversees the Charlotte area transit system. Steve, you reported that at Wednesday's meeting, Cornelius Mayor Woody Washam said that he's concerned about how this violent incident, this killing that just occurred on the Blue Line, could affect the November referendum on whether to pass the increase the sales tax by 1% to pay for new roads in the transit plan. Washam expressed condolences to the victim's family and said people in North Mecklenburg are concerned about safety.
I think it's going to be difficult. I really do, because, you know, there's just a lot of chatter out there, particularly as it relates. It's sad that it relates to the fact that we've got a vote coming up in November on transit tax. It brings on some negatives in relation to the rail services and all that overall.
So, Steve, do you think that is a fair concern that Mayor Washam has?
Yeah, I think it's definitely a problem. And it's interesting kind of watching the elected officials in response to this tragedy. They are very concerned, but there's very few elected officials want to link and talk about the murder to the vote in November, in part because they don't want people to have this idea in their mind that they're connected. And in part, they don't want to appear like that they're thinking about politics and this future vote at this time, you know, of this terrible tragedy. So most people are kind of working very hard to walk this fine line about what to say. But in that instance, Woody Washam just kind of came out and laid it on the table, and that he's really worried about what the impacts this will be in November.
I want to take a couple years back in time and kind of put what happened a couple weeks ago on the Blue Line in perspective. For those of us who have been covering Charlotte for a while, you know, when I heard about this, I immediately thought about the shooting death of the Cats bus driver, Ethan Rivera, back in 2022. Can we read the tea leaves at all of how we're going to look at this incident? I mean, it's not just one incident of violence that's occurred on mass transit in Charlotte. It is part of a bigger picture. So how does this kind of fit in as far as how we'll look at mass transit and safety concerns in the future? Joe, I'm going to toss it to you.
I think after Ethan Rivera was murdered, there was a big push for bus driver safety. And that was one of the first major linchpins of CATS really cracking down and investing in their drivers and bus operators and making sure that they are safe. We saw a number of different proposals, bulletproof glass. One of them was proposed at one point. And it kind of reflected in CATS's priorities when it came time to change the security contract and get the new vendor in this year. The first thing they did was secure the transit center and make security enhancements for bus drivers. So one of the main things that happened after the Ethan Rivera death was investing in bus safety. And I think that Irina Zarutska's killing is now going to have a similar impact on the light rail.
Well, related to the transit tax, a Charlotte City Council committee on Tuesday approved a framework for appointing board members to a new transit authority, which would be enacted if voters approve a new 1-cent sales tax in November. Some officials, however, were skeptical, even some of those who voted yes. If voters approved the tax increase referendum, CATS would be overseen by a new transit authority led by a 27-member board with members appointed from across Mecklenburg County. The city of Charlotte currently operates the system. In a procedural move on Tuesday, Council's Transportation Committee voted 4-1 for the framework for appointments. So I'm going to stop there. When I heard 27-member board, I thought, oh boy, that's a lot of cooks in the kitchen. How did they get to 27 people being on the board? Why is that the right number, Steve?
How did they get there? I think the main, the legislature in Raleigh put this bill together. I think there was input from the city of Charlotte and local leaders. But you're right, Sarah, 27 is a huge number of people. And one of the big points of contention on this board is that some of the critics or skeptics of the transit plan want to make sure that there is representation from people who use mass transit all the time. And the problem is that the legislation calls for all of the appointees to have expertise in certain areas like finance or engineering or urban planning, things like that. So you can have a user of mass transit on the board and be appointed, but they also need, in theory, some other area of expertise to go along with that.
Committee Chair Ed Driggs noted that the legislation requires appointees to have specific qualifications, like you mentioned, Steve, such as knowledge in finance and engineering. And he said that's a good thing.
So if somebody says I meet the public transportation requirement because I've been riding a bus for 10 years, in my mind, that is not the person we want on a board running a very large organization.
I think an argument could be made, though, that someone who uses public transportation regularly would be a real asset to this board. What do we think that Driggs is getting at here, Ben? Ben, I'll ask you first.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the idea of that you want experts calling the shots, I think that's overall, broadly speaking, a great idea, especially when you're talking about something as complicated as a multi-billion dollar transit plan like that. However, the whole point of this is to serve the riders and make sure that they are their needs are actually being met in this transit plan. And I think that has been a complaint from day one, going back years, is making sure that this plan, sure, it provides economic, boost to certain neighborhoods, and yeah, it does this, but also that it serves the people who need it most. And if you don't have any of those people necessarily on this big board, then what keeps it in check? If you don't have the guy who takes the bus in East Charlotte every single day, or you don't have somebody who's living up in Cornelius and riding the red line every day, then honestly, what kind of accountability are you going to have if you don't have people, real people, who actually see the inner workings and the problems on a day-to-day basis?
Joe, I also saw your head nodding. And if not, that's okay. We do have lots more news to cover. Speaking of Charlotte City Council and transit, some news came down on Thursday about former city council member Tariq Bakari, who also has ties to transit. Joe, you reported that Bakari is no longer deputy administrator for the Federal Transit Administration. A spokesperson for the FTA confirmed the departure. So let's remind listeners, when did Bakari resign from council, and what was this new job supposed to be all about?
And I'm so sorry, my computer here that I'm trying to broadcast from, I'm just having so many internet issues. For Tariq Bakari here, it did come as a bit of a surprise. Yesterday, I saw that his biography was removed from the FTA's website. And the FTA provided me a short statement saying that basically he is no longer... His time with federal service has ended. We thank him for his contributions. So it appears that, so he confirmed this after we reported that he is no longer there. He says that this 5-month period kind of was in the cards for him, that this was a transition that he was hoping to, that this was the right time for him to leave the position, that this was in the plans. He is proud of what he's accomplished. It felt like a lot longer, and that he wants to return home, be with his family, help his wife with her political campaign.
Yeah. Ben.
Yeah. I also think it's interesting, and I'm not going off of anything more than the statement that Tark sent out and posted on social media as well. But not only in April when he left city council early to take on this position, it was for, you know, deputy administrator at the FDA. But not only that, but most of the summer, it should be said that he served as acting administrator of the FDA, and was making announcements like the acting administrator was signing things like the acting administrator. And the actual administrator, Mark Molinaro, didn't start till about a month ago. So we have the timeline of him starting in April, him serving basically as acting administrator for months, the actual administrator starting about a little more than a month ago to the day. And this, what appeared to be to most of us who covered this, a bit of an abrupt announcement yesterday.
He did post on X, formerly known as Twitter, about his departure and wrote that one of the various projects he was proud to be a part of over the last 5 months was an initiative highlighting a jumpstart of a 10-year vision to take the global lead in autonomous transit. And he added that the timing is right for me to hand the baton to the next wave of leaders to carry on the amazing work that's underway and head back to my beloved North Carolina, where I can focus on my wife's important campaign, my family and business. While Bakari was serving in Washington, his family was still here in Charlotte, and his wife, Krista Bakari, is running for the District 6 position on Charlotte City Council. She had run against Edwin Peacock to serve the remainder of Tark's term, but was ultimately defeated. Any thoughts on what is next for Tark Bakari? Joe?
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if he's in the mix for this transit board, one of those 27 positions, given his background. But I think in the immediate future, he will help his wife with her campaign. She has to get through the primary. But as we know, the Bakari campaign is always full of surprises. He flew a plane over a polling site last year. If I know him, I would think that he'll have some tricks up his sleeve should Krista make it past the primary, because it will be a bruising fight against Kimberly Owens, I'm sure. So he has a business as well. I think Tark will be fine. There's probably some additional reporting that does need to be done to find out, you know, what exactly happened with this 5 month tenure up in Washington. But in the immediate future, I think his focus is Krista and her race.
Ben.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting, and you mentioned this, him touting this 10-year vision to take the global lead when it comes to autonomous transit. That is actually while he was on council, and when the issue of the transit plan, which we were talking about before, when it came up, that's one thing he would consistently beat the drum on, that though he was supportive of the transit plan, that it didn't have, it was not forward looking enough, and didn't take into account autonomous vehicles enough and that sort of thing. And so to have that be sort of a feather in his cap from his 5 months in federal government is not really a big surprise.
Well, in case you didn't know, there is a Charlotte City Council primary going on. We've alluded to it throughout the show. Charlotte is the only city or town in the region with elections in September. Others will have to wait till November. Hundreds of thousands of people are eligible to vote, but entering this week, less than 1,000 voters had cast ballots. But it's not for lack of voting locations. There are now 9 locations open that voters can go to before the actual election day, which is Tuesday, September 9th. So, Steve, I'm going to turn to you as our political reporter. What races are on the ballot for those who may just be learning that there is a primary going on?
Yeah, so there are at the top of the ballot, there are races, although they're not particularly, you know, not as competitive as what's at the bottom. There is a Democratic primary for mayor. There's a Democratic primary for the 4 at-large seats. But the real action is at the district level on city council. And there are some pretty competitive races. There is a Republican primary, as Joe talked about, for District 6 in South Charlotte. There is a and there are a couple of other really high profile races. Tijuana Brown is being challenged in District 3 in West Charlotte. She, of course, is under federal indictment. That's drawn a lot of attention. And in East Charlotte in District 5, there's a really, really contentious race between the incumbent Marjorie Molina and her opponent, J.D. Masuera-Arias. So I think there are some pretty spicy races this time. And when we look at early voting, the numbers have started to pick up, and there are more people have voted early now at this point than they did 2 years ago, which is a good sign.
And we should mention that J.D. Masuera-Reyes is the partner of WFAE reporter Julian Berger. He is not involved in any reporting or editorial decision making about city council coverage. Let's talk about the early voting numbers. So heading into this week, there were less than 1,000 voters who had cast ballots. Do we have a sense of if that number is updated, Joe?
Yes. So it was like a pathetic turnout, like up until Tuesday. And Hal Marshall Center was the only early voting place open up until that point, which, you know, yeah, it's a decrepit old building tucked in the middle of Uptown, but there's still tens of thousands of people who work in Uptown. So I like kind of buy the like there's only one polling location, but also still like there should be more people voting in that time frame. Anyway, we ran a story on Monday saying like, yo, there's an election going on. What's going on, guys? Cast your ballot. And thankfully, now we are seeing better than expected or usual turnout. It's been about 2,200 or so votes cast each day, which was more than any day last time in 2023 for the primary. And there were more primary sites open last time as well. So there is a good trend with in-person early voting. It's still not going to be great, the turnout at the end of all of this. Your vote is still going to be incredibly impactful and determine whether some of these, determine exactly who some of these representatives are.
Ben.
At the end of early voting 2 years ago, I believe there were just shy of about 8,600 people who had early voted. As of our most recent numbers yesterday, it's 7,800. By the time early voting is finished tomorrow, it's believed that that number will be higher than it was 2 years ago. But before we pat ourselves on the back and say we turned out, I believe 2 years ago, there was 5% voter turnout overall in the municipal election. Mm. So which is just atrocious. So by all accounts, we're 2 years ago was a very, very low bar. So we are hoping that anyway, anyhow, we'll get much higher than that.
Well, to get into the minds of voters for a second, there are some races that are seemingly feel like they are decided. Could voters be having some sort of existential crisis wondering the value of their vote in this specific primary on Tuesday?
I really think the main reason people aren't voting is because they don't know an election is going on, just with being off year. I think those who follow or have been following city council in any capacity over the past year would be motivated to vote just because of all of the controversies and things going on, and they have an opinion about how they were handled one way or the other. You know, Republicans, they only have one race that they can vote on. Only a small portion of Republicans can cast a ballot, and they have to live in District 6. But for everyone else, you're deciding at least the at-large race and the mayoral race. And those are very interesting if you're paying closely attention.
We'll keep the conversation going after a short break. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, home ownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Sarah D'Elia. It's Local News Roundup. And our roundtable of reporters this morning includes Joe Bruno from WSOC, Steve Harrison and James Farrell from WFAE, and Ben Thompson, the midday morning anchor for WCNC. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. James, especially, I want to thank you. You have been patiently waiting your turn to talk about education. Thank you for waiting so long. We have a lot to talk about when it comes to education. There's been a lot on the minds of families in the county. Test scores, statewide test scores, have been released. Heading into this week, Charlotte-Mecklenburg Schools hinted that these results were going to be historic. So give us the skinny, James. Was this news historic? And if so, what was it?
Yeah, they definitely had a historic year when it comes to looking at their school performance grades. So for parents, that would be the letter grade for your school that you may have looked up when you were trying to figure out where your kid was going to go to school. They saw dramatic improvements in that regard. There were 55 schools across the district that saw their letter grade go up. That's the most CMS has ever seen. They also saw a lot of improvements in school growth, which refers to the amount The percentage that they increase their grade level proficiency at each school. So 89% of schools across the district either met or exceeded their growth expectations. Again, that's the highest that CMS has ever seen. And I think that what stood out for me the most was that they really drastically cut the number of low performing schools in the district. So a low performing school, that's a state designation that goes to a school that has a D or an F rating and doesn't meet its growth expectations. So CMS cut that. Last year, there were 32% of schools across the district that were low performing. This year, that's down to 18%. That's a really dramatic cut. And in that regard, it was a pretty historic year when it comes at least to looking at individual school performances and how they fared on their school report cards.
CMS Chief Innovation and Strategy Officer Beth Thompson said 31 CMS schools are no longer deemed as low performing, as you mentioned, James, and that's the largest single year drop in CMS history. And it also brings the total low performing CMS schools in the district to 32, or 18%. Here's Thompson.
We learned that if we focus all of our support only on schools with the low performing designation, we run the risk of neglecting the needed support that will cause other schools to receive that designation for the upcoming school year.
CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill wants to have zero schools with an F rating by next year. James, how realistic is that?
Well, again, this was a really drastic drop to go from 32% of schools in the district being low performing to 18%. They still have work to do, obviously, to do that. I think that what Beth Thompson was alluding to there marks kind of an interesting shift of strategy from the district to take kind of a more district-wide approach to providing supports as opposed to only targeting the schools that were deemed low performing or that may be struggling. You know, and to kind of put that in perspective, last year they had a pretty good drop in schools from the list as well, but then they also added 17 new schools to the low performing list. This year they reduced that number down to 7. So by kind of spreading the supports throughout the district, they were able to kind of stop additional schools from going on to that list. So I think that the district feels like they have really good strategies in their data and the way that they kind of analyze student data throughout the year and try to jump in, provide targeted supports to students when they can see like individual students struggling and things like that. And certainly on a statewide level, at least in terms of reading, we know that the state has invested a lot of money into the science of reading and training teachers on the science of reading. And state leaders have hinted that we're not going to see the real benefits of that until this school year. So obviously that remains to be seen. We'll see if that plays out. But if all those things are combined, I think it is possible. There's obviously still some work that has to be done to get there, though.
All right, let's talk about neighborhood school letter grades. As you mentioned, James, you might learn about these from a realtor if you're shopping for a home and you want to be in a good school area, or, you know, just thinking about where you want to send your kid, what kind of experience would they want to have. There's a lot more to a North Carolina school report card, though, than the letter grade to give. It goes beyond. There's more context than just the letter. Those insights might make you feel a little bit differently about the letter grade. So, James, how should parents be reading into these letter grades that schools are given? What do they actually tell us?
Yeah, I think it's important for parents to just know what that letter grade is referring to. So the letter grade is calculated from two main things, which first is the percentage of students that graduated that reached grade level proficiency on their state standardized tests in a given year. That accounts for about 80% of the calculation. The other 20% refers to the growth, the level at which the school improved on its students reaching grade level proficiency from one year to the next. There is a lot of debate over this. There's been a lot of calls in recent years to maybe reassess how we do these letter grades. State Superintendent Mo Green, who's a Democrat, has advocated for that, as did his predecessor, Catherine Truitt, who is a Republican. So this is something that education leaders have talked about a lot. In particular, there's been conversation about whether we should increase the weighting of the growth factor. Some people think that growth is a better indicator of a school's quality than just a snapshot of how students did on one particular week. And then there's a lot of things that are not factored into the grade at all. For instance, the rigor of courses is not always factored into it. So there's a lot of debate as to whether or not there's more we can do to kind of show what that letter grade is representing. Now, when you go onto the state website and go onto your school report card, you can find a lot of information there that is not reflected in the letter grade. Things like school safety, class size, the qualifications of teachers at the school. So I would recommend to any parent who's trying to navigate all of this to not just look at the letter, but go into the report card and see maybe there's things there that really matter to you. Again, class size is something a lot of parents are concerned about. They don't want their kids being in a room that's, you know, overwhelming for a single teacher. And all of that is not necessarily reflected in the letter grade, but you can find that information on the school report card.
How long does it take for a school's letter grade to change for better or for worse? I mean, does it typically change from year to year, or how does that work?
I think it depends on the school, and it depends, again, on that growth factor. I mean, we heard from some principals at the press event where they debuted all these scores who were able to show drastic improvements over the course of, say, 2 or 3 years. Tuckasegee Elementary School, for instance, went from a D to a B, I think, in about 2 years. But that was after a really exceptional period of growth that was exceeding expectations by quite a bit. So I think it usually takes a few years to kind of get on that kind of a pace. But it varies from school to school.
Well, there's been some more good news when it comes to the state's high school graduation average. North Carolina State Superintendent Mo Green told the State Board of Education that the state's high school graduation average last year was almost 88%. He also says the state had a record-breaking year for students completing and passing AP courses.
These results, I believe, represent more than just mere numbers. They represent thousands of students who are better prepared for their next phase in life.
So what do these figures say about the state of education in North Carolina and especially CMS, James?
Well, so for Mo Green, this is something that he's definitely going to tout as a, you know, in his first year as superintendent. He and the State Board of Education worked together on a joint strategic plan for the school system here in North Carolina, and graduation rates was a big part of that. He has kind of an ambitious goal to try to get what he would call the best graduation rate in the nation by 2030. And this is, you know, in his mind, a step in that direction. I think it's worth noting this was maybe the one part in the CMS scores that was not as historic as, you know, the school report cards and the school performance grades. CMS's graduation rate dipped down a little bit and is below what the state is doing right now. That being said, CMS has put a lot of its emphasis in recent years. This past school year, they set a goal on trying to make sure all students who graduate are on track to be enrolled, enlisted, or employed. So that's where they've concerted a lot of their effort in the last year. So that's dealing with kids who have already graduated. Now, CMS has said they're still focusing on that graduation rate, but it is a district goal to improve that part of it. So we'll see if that kind of changes now, as we know that the state is focusing on graduation rate and with what the graduation rate at CMS showed us this year.
WFAE's education reporter James Farrell, thanks for joining us, James.
You got it.
Charlotte City Council's Jobs and Economic Development Committee heard new plans Tuesday for how to redevelop a historic West Charlotte club. The Excelsior Club on Beatty's Ford Road has sat empty since closing in 2016 and fell into disrepair. The building is, or it was, a home converted into a club in 1944. It was once a popular gathering spot for African Americans in the city. Several previous attempts to redevelop the property have fallen through. The latest effort is led by Sean Kennedy of Kennedy Property and Development and Tim Statima of Crossland Southeast. The proposed redevelopment is expected to cost $7.8 million, with the group requesting $1.5 million each from the city and Mecklenburg County. What do we know about these developers?
Basically, like the past project, it was a remodel or a renovation of the existing structure. And this structure is in terrible shape right now. And I think that's one of the major reasons why it never took off. This new project is a tear down of the existing historic site and like a near replica with the rebuild. And I think doing it this way makes it more likely something will happen. You'll lose the history, but in return, you'll actually get something on the site. Now, I do think that city council members and Mecklenburg County commissioners are going to have to make the case to the public that this is a worthwhile investment of public money, because it is $3 million at the end of the day investing in a club or a lounge. And there are people who are going to question whether Charlotte should use tax dollars or COVID dollars on what is essentially a nightclub. Notwithstanding, this is a very historic club and is a very important development, but city council members and Mecklenburg County commissioners still are going to need to tell the public why they want to invest money into what will essentially be like a lounge slash historic museum.
Ben.
And I think also that the neighborhoods have changed there substantially in the last few years. Why? And that could be a reason why previous attempts to sort of create a new future for this, why this time it might actually work, because Washington Heights is growing across the street. Macquarie Heights is growing. There are townhomes going in just a block down Beatty's Ford Road, about a mile north on Beatty's Ford Road. There's a popular coffee shop that's gone in. So you do have a bit of a critical mass there on Beatty's Ford Road in West Charlotte that is growing and developing and coming about that wasn't really happening a few years ago. Parking has been a problem in past iterations of this plan. In the past, people were allowed to park over across the street at the Vest Water Treatment Plant. That is now all fenced off. So any new plan going forward will have to accommodate that sort of parking. But this is perhaps more promising than we've had in a long time.
When I heard about this story, and again, as someone who's covered Charlotte for over 10 years, the Excelsior Club, that has been something that's been in and out of the news cycle over the last decade. It's hard not to think about what's happened with Brooklyn Village and sort of that falling apart and trying to get that project off the ground. It's another historic, important piece of Black history in Charlotte. Are there some parallels between these two projects at all, Joe?
Maybe. I do think this is the right development team, though. Croslin Southeast has a proven track record, for example. Like, they're the ones who are doing Eastland Yards right now. And I think that the other developer involved, the Kennedy team, he will be the owner of the site. He's saying the right things. He's like, this is going to be a generational thing that I'm going to pass down. Like, this is a legacy project. With Brooklyn Village, as Steve has noted, there were kind of warning signs at the start, and those warnings and red flags have continued throughout the whole tenure. And I certainly see parallels in the fact that this is something that people want, and there have been a number of plans, and everything has just fallen through. But with this proposal and what they are wanting to do with the site and the way they're trying to build it, I think it will work if they can convince the public that this is a good investment of their money.
Well, the Panthers kick off their season this weekend. And for a preview of the season, be sure to check out Charlotte Talks from Thursday of this week. Soon-to-be Panthers wide receiver Hunter Renfrow was receiving call after call from the Carolina Panthers last week while he was helping his uncle in South Carolina. He left his phone with his daughter, who ignored 10 calls from the head coach of the Panthers, the general manager, and his agent. The reason for the missed calls? His daughter was watching Bluey on his phone, a.k.a. the soundtrack of many parents' homes that just plays over and over in your mind. It was a real Oh Biscuits moment for Renfrow. That's all the time we have this morning for Charlotte Talks. I want to thank my guests, Joe Bruno from WSOC, Steve Harrison, political reporter for WFAE, James Farrell, our education reporter, and Ben Thompson, the morning and midday anchor at WCNC. I'm Sarah D'Elia. It's Charlotte Talks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.